when the Islamic nation, when the Iranian nation has decided, then America has no right, then the foreign countries have no right to say that they want a change of regime. There is no meaning of this word, because it was people who, through the referendum, has approved that this country must become an Islamic Republic country, a Republic of Islam. This must be become an Islamic Republic country. So when this is happened by the people, by those who were at that time, who were in charge of the country, who have done this movement, who overthrown the rulership of the king before the revolution, it was their right. And no one has right to say that they want a change of regime in this country, in this state, because this is the very first right of these people, because they have stamped this country, this state, to be Islamic. And that's why Imam Khomeini has said that the important thing is that we feel certain in our hearts that we want our republic to be Islamic.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
On the 3rd of January 2020, Iran's most powerful military commander, General Qasem Soleimani, was killed by a US military airstrike in Iraq.
The 62-year-old general was the key military leader in the Middle East and led operations as head of Iran's elite Quds force. The general was widely regarded as a heroic national figure, in part because he was instrumental in the destruction of the ISIL terrorist organization after the failure of the West to achieve this outcome. The general was killed at Baghdad airport, along with other Iran-backed militia figures, in a strike ordered by US President Donald Trump. 2 years later, the assassination remains unexplained and almost forgotten by the Western media. Yet his killing provoked a wave of mourning and rage against the assassinating country, America. Indeed, to the public in Iran and to many abroad, part of the impact was to serve as yet another example of Western military policy carried out to the illegal killing of a senior member of another country's military force.
How many people in Britain are aware of General Soleimani's essential role in fighting ISIL? And how would people here feel if such a key player in this country were assassinated by a foreign power? Simple questions with important answers. And let's begin by establishing the extent of public awareness of the general, his work, and his assassination. We asked the public in London if they'd heard of Qasem Soleimani, and if not, whether they could guess his country of origin. Here's what they said. There's a person called Qasem Soleimani. Have you heard of him, or do you think maybe you've heard of him? Can you guess what he does, or maybe where he came from, even if it's a guess?
Iran, maybe.
He's from Iran, and is a general. That's what I heard.
General Soleimani was primarily responsible for destroying the terrorist organization ISIL after the West proved unable to do so. Is the public aware of this? And what do they think of the fact this achievement was carried out by an Iranian general? What do you think of that achievement? And were you aware of the fact an Iranian general basically was responsible for killing ISIL?
No, not at all. I thought it was probably a combination of the Iraqis and the Americans.
Did you know that achievement? What do you think about it?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that. I think that's great.
Are you surprised that it was actually an Iranian general who basically led this? And what do you think of that achievement?
I don't. I'm not surprised in the slightest. I think that generally people who are local and have the knowledge and power and vested interest and know their communities and know the people are going to be the people best suited and best able because they're going to have the support of local people because they're from there and they want to do it.
Have you seen anything in the media about him?
No. The only reason why I think I know this is, was he targeted? And he was killed by a drone attack, is that right? Yeah, okay, so I think I do know him. It was the Americans. Yeah, sure, right. Yeah, I know who we're talking about now.
No, I didn't know it, but obviously it's quite an achievement. ISIL was quite a terrifying organisation. Yeah. So, well done him, but...
Now that you've mentioned the guy does ring a bell.
There's not a huge amount in the media. You get sort of some news stories and obviously some things filter through, but it's just the stories don't necessarily there and names don't always ring bells. So I think unless you're really trying to keep up to date with everything, it's very easy to miss us. There's an awful lot that goes on in the world.
I don't know what surprised me anymore. So I'm surprised that you don't hear about it on the media, I guess. But also, I don't know, on the media you hear random stuff, so... I guess it's surprising, but also it's not.
I'm actually quite surprised to hear this, I'm not going to lie, especially because we haven't heard anything about this in the media, I mean, especially not in London, so yeah, actually, very surprised.
General Soleimani has not been widely recognised for his work in destroying ISIL, but what would have been the reaction if a British or an American general, instead of an Iranian one, had brought down that terrorist movement?
I'm surprised. I don't know either. I'm not huge on history. I don't know a lot, but I'm surprised.
If a British or an American general had been responsible for destroying ISIL, how much coverage do you think that would have got? How much of a hero would that person have been instead of being an Iranian general?
He would probably have a huge statue built up somewhere here, maybe in central London. Being in London, that would be a huge deal for the British people. I wish there was more recognition.
Oh, I'm sure there would have been a lot of press publicity about it. There was when they took down Saddam Hussein. Yeah, so I would imagine it would have been somewhat similar.
There would have been a lot more publicity around it. They would have made a lot more out of that fact that he was British or American. Yeah. Yeah.
Why was the same not happening for the Iranian general?
I don't know, but maybe the media outlets are very, very biased and have a very, very narrow view on what they want to show and what people are interested in.
Britain seems to just be very inward-looking these days. I don't know. And then, of course, I think I suppose the media also report what they think people will be interested in, I guess. There's a lot of interesting things happening that we never get to hear of, you know.
I think I'd have heard an awful lot more about it if it had been a British or an American general who'd done that. You'd have had it all over the news. We probably would have had someone with knighthood honours by now. And, just would have had a lot more generally in the general consciousness.
Would the reaction be different for a British or American general versus an Iranian one?
I think so, yeah. Why? There's such a divide of us versus them. I think it would be natural for... us to find pride in it's us that have fought the bad guys and won.
The noise that comes out of how war gets narrated, I suppose. I'm very distrustful of anything with a British badge on it anyway, I guess, just from coming from Northern Ireland. So, I probably wouldn't have tuned into it no matter what it was. And our papers are full of scandalous things about celebrities and Brexit related stuff, a lot of it extremely tedious.
I think media just show us what they want us to see, and I think that explains completely why we haven't heard about this, and it would have been completely different for sure. I would have been able to know who did this and to talk a bit more about it.
Yeah, I suppose it's like I'm just really surprised that today is the first day that I've really heard about it. That seems absurd given how big the event was and how, if it was the other way around, we definitely would have heard about it. So I feel a bit ignorant that there's really been no coverage here, or at least not what I've seen.
Yeah, I think it would have been probably quite big in the media. People would have known and heard of him.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and I think, but I think the media is always Western leaning, isn't it? So, and it's easier to prop up someone who is a face that we all recognise and can get behind. That's been the case for years, where I think if the viewers don't see themselves in it, they don't relate, and therefore it's not TV worthy.
General Soleimani, who was Iranian, he's not really been recognised in the West at all, as far as I can see, for destroying ISIL. What would have been the reaction if a British or an American general had demonstrably destroyed ISIL?
Well, they would have been feted, so knighted of some sort and some sort of medal. So, yeah. I thought he was... Didn't the Americans assassinate him via a drone? Yeah, so I have heard of him, yeah.
Let's look at the legal issues. Washington ratified the Charter of the United Nations and is therefore bound by it. Agnes Callamard, UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary or Arbitrary Executions, stated the Soleimani assassination could only be justified in response to an imminent threat. She believes Washington has provided no such evidence, concluding the course of action taken by the US was unlawful, adding, even at the most basic level, the US did not demonstrate that striking Soleimani was necessary. Calamard also warned it was the first targeted drone killing of a senior foreign government official on the territory of a third country, and that the world now faces the very real prospect that states may opt to strategically eliminate high-ranking military officials outside the context of a known war. The fact that by 2028 the USA aims to have 1,000 unmanned combat drones makes it the prime candidate for carrying out further such assassinations.
General Soleimani was assassinated by American operatives on the orders of then-American President Donald Trump. Does the public know this, and what do they think of the fact this killing was sponsored by a US president?
I think it's completely sick. I mean, Donald Trump, I mean, he's completely crazy to me, to be honest, but to know that it's an assassination and the man is just walking free and no one has heard of it is even more insane, to be honest. Yeah, feel sick a little bit.
I've heard of a drone strike and Donald Trump, I'm not surprised. what do I think of it? I mean, it's probably not the last drone strike that we will hear of, so I hope that we will have a right framework to deal with those things in the future.
I may be feeling cynical, but I'm not surprised, I guess. Like, I don't, and I wouldn't be surprised if Boris Johnson did the same thing. I think we're a little better than America on that front, for sure. And I grew up around people who don't behave that way and have similar surnames and all those things, but my brain still thinks that way because of the media that we're around. So it's easier for Donald Trump to just come on live TV and celebrate something that is illegal because he knows that everyone else will be like, well, that probably tracks, because of the way we're kind of geared to see those things. So, like, just hearing the surname Soleimani, like, my surname's Hussein. Like, I grew up with getting teased for that, and it's like, your automatic assumptions when you ask a question like that is a bit unfortunate. So
outrageous, and that, you know, basically, like all war crimes, you should really have it brought to justice. It shouldn't be acceptable for someone from one nation to go off and kill someone else because of whatever beliefs they have. So
I'm not surprised. You know, I've got no time for Donald Trump, and I can't understand the support that he has, or that he has had, I suppose. But it's not like it's the first time that sort of shenanigans has gone on, I guess.
It does feel like it was a murder, and I, the fact that Trump carried it out is probably confirms in my mind that it was not a good thing.
There's a complete misalignment there with the kind of what happened. I mean, Donald Trump, I suppose, was unique, you hope, so I'm not sure how reflective that is of kind of American politics generally, but yeah, that does seem like there is something unfinished there that needs to perhaps be looked into, I guess.
If a British or an American general were assassinated on the orders of a foreign power, what would be the reaction? And to what extent does the public feel this is a classic case of double standards?
I'm sure it's been attempted, but I think if it was, there'd be a reaction from the West that the Middle East has never seen. So behind the scenes, covertly and overtly. So, which I think is the reason that the balance of order is maintained. But yeah, you're right, there's a degree of double standards, but at the same time,
it's state-sponsored terrorism, isn't it? So he has been in the past implicated and proven that he's taken part in numerous attacks against the West or the interests of the West.
Yeah, there would be total uproar, I think, if it happened here, because people don't believe in that sort of thing generally, do they?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure there are double standards in the world all over the place. And yeah, the reaction would have been different. If it had been the head of the British forces, it would have been all over our news. Was it all over the Iranian news? Then that's what you would expect, for it to be more publicised in the relevant country. But yeah, we would have heard about it, and so would the rest of the world if it had been one of ours.
And if the head of the British army was assassinated by anyone, not least from the Middle East, that there would be, it wouldn't be very good. I think it would be a pretty sight, probably lead to war. Yeah.
Britain's built on double standards. You know, the whole, that's what the empire is all about. You know what I mean? It's about power and control. So, of course, people would be outraged, you know. But, yeah, as in, you don't have to go very far to see that double standard play out again and again and again. So, again, it's not surprising.
I don't know enough about it, so I'm now intrigued and interested to go and find out more. And I think part of the difficulty is that we're so often not given the facts, and that news is sold as fact, where it's not. And I think particularly in the last couple of years, we've been inundated with data and statistics, and we're either left to process them ourselves, or we're relying on someone to interpret them for us. And I think often we're sold information through news and media that's fact when it's not. And so you have to question everything behind it. And I think if someone had been, who was British, had been shot, then it would have been seen as a murder and everything. I just think I look at the word refugee and migrant, and that's what we call people who come to this country. And yet when you go abroad, a British person is called an expatriate. There's something charming about it, you know. There's so many double standards about how we perceive where people are from and what right they have to access resources and that nationality and that country, and why were we even in Iran and Iraq in the first place? What was in it for Britain? And I think we were probably missold while we were there in the first place.
I certainly don't think that government should be involved in assassinating people in general. I don't think that's their role. I don't know what Iran's reaction is to this event. So, you know, for me, I wouldn't be able to say whether it's double standards, because I don't know, you know, how they're perceiving it, how they're reacting to it.
I don't know if I could call it double standards, but we tend to publicly. We tend to say things that are basically what the people want to hear and what the government wants to portray at the time.
The double standards, yes, but that would be a double standard.
Why did we get away with it?
Because we're in a stronger position.
Yes, there are double standards, and that's simply because the lives in the Middle East are worth less than the lives in the West, because that's the way we're all grown up to think. Like, that's just how it works. Like, it's always been the case. Like, the British Empire believes that they are going around and healing the earth because they think that their lives are better than the others, and that's been the case for hundreds of years. And I feel like sometimes it's better to let a country learn its own lessons and be its own culture, and that means, you know, some countries have things that we would see as distasteful or not quite what we want, but that's not necessarily meaning we need to go in and interrupt. So I didn't really quite answer the direct question that you asked, but none of that stuff surprises me. It's a symptom of Western culture for the last hundreds of years, basically.
I think if that had happened, we'd be at war right now. We all know the reaction to 9/11. It was pretty unequivocal that we went straight into the Middle East, and I think if a drone strike went and killed a head of state in a UK or an American country, something similar would happen again. So, yeah, we're absolutely guilty of double standards.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I feel like wherever you go, you'll find double standards. If a scenario like this would repeat itself with other people in the spotlight, the response in the media would be very different.
If a British general or an American general was assassinated because of a head of state in a
Middle East saying so. What do you think would happen? Would we go into war? I mean, do you think they're a double standard?
Yeah, definitely. I do. Particularly thinking about it now, being asked, I think that there would be outcry. Yeah, there'd be uproar if it was the other way around.
Are we guilty of double standards towards the Middle East?
Oh my God, completely. The double standards are really, really obvious in that case, specifically, I think, because I think the public opinion would have been completely crazy. And yeah, I think there would have been really, really heavy repercussion. The media would have, like, used that story again and again and again, and here we are. We haven't heard of it.
I'm sure it would be headlines, you know, terrorist attack, you know, Iranian person killed huge leader in the UK. They would probably use that as a justification to start another, you know, not a war, but some kind of conflict. And I studied human geography, so we did a lot of politics, geopolitics, and it's crazy how countries just hide behind these excuses of, oh, they did this, so therefore we have to do this to counter it. But
General Qasem Soleimani was killed by America, but mourned by Iran and many others. Yet few in the West have any real idea about the huge contribution the general made in putting right what the West did wrong, especially in relation to ISIL. Worse still, few doubt the strength of reaction if a Western figure of General Soleimani's stature were assassinated on the orders of another nation's head of state.
It's clear that Washington has been unable to justify the killing of a man who saved the Middle East and the world from ISIL, a terror group largely created by Western military miscalculations. Though the Western public is not encouraged to know the truth, many insist these facts are shared. Yet if such an attack were carried out against a Western power, it could lead to invasion or even war. For many, this death by double standards continues to stain the reputation of the West, because the years since the murder of General Soleimani do not diminish the crime.
Thank you.
the limelight. A Georgia judge on Friday, 7th of January, sentenced both Travis McMichael, the man who fatally shot Ahmed Arbery, and his father, to life in prison without the possibility of parole, but issued a lesser sentence of life with the possibility of parole to the other white man convicted of murdering Mr. Arbery, a 25-year-old black man whom they had chased through their neighborhood. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Richard Fawcett. The piece is titled, Three Men Sentenced to Life in Prison in Arbery Killing. Georgia judge on Friday, 7th of January, sentenced both Travis McMichael, the man who fatally shot Ahmed Arbery, and his father, to life in prison without the possibility of parole, but issued a lesser sentence of life with the possibility of parole to the other white man convicted of murdering Mr. Arbery, a 25-year-old black man whom they had chased through their neighborhood. The three men, Travis McMichael, 35, his father, Gregory McMichael, 66, and their neighbor, William Bryan, 52, were convicted of murder and other counts in state court in November, resulting in mandatory life sentences. The main question before Judge Timothy Walmsley on Friday was whether Mr. Arbery's murderers should be eligible for parole after 30 years, the earliest possible opportunity for such offenders under Georgia law. The lead prosecutor in the case, Linda Donikowski, asked the judge to deny the possibility of parole to the McMichaels, arguing that they had displayed a reckless history of vigilantism before the killing. She noted that the elder Mr. McMichael had used a disparaging term about Mr. Arbery as his body lay in the street, and authorities responded. There's been no remorse and certainly no empathy from either man, she said. She said that Mr. Bryan should be eligible for parole in part because he had cooperated with investigators. Before issuing the sentences, Judge Walmsley noted that Mr. Arbery had been chased for roughly 5 minutes while he ran from the men on foot. To illustrate the sense of time and to emphasize the terror that he said Ahmed Arbery must have felt, the judge paused and let silence fill the courtroom for 1 minute. Judge Timothy Walmsley said the case should prompt people to consider what it meant to be a good neighbor. Assuming the worst in others, we show our worst character, he said. Judge Timothy Walmsley's decision in the same Brunswick, Georgia courtroom where the racially charged trial unfolded marked a dramatic moment in a saga that engulfed a small coastal community and then a nation. For weeks after the killing, the three men walked free as a prosecutor initially advised the police that they should not be arrested because they were covered by the state citizens' arrest law and because the shooting was a justified act of self-defense. The judge's decision on Friday, 7th of January, closed one important chapter in the case against the men who killed Ahmed Arbery, who had entered a house under construction in the suburban community of Satilla Shores on a Sunday afternoon in February of 2020. The three men pursued him in a pair of trucks, suspecting him of property crimes in the area. The chase ended when Ahmed Arbery, blocked in by the trucks, clashed physically with Travis McMichael, who shot Mr. Arbery 3 times at close range with a shotgun. Mr. Bryan captured the slaying on his cell phone camera, and then the footage was widely distributed online. It stirred national outrage. On Friday, 7th of January, Ahmed Arbery's family members gave a series of wrenching statements to the judge, arguing that the men should receive the maximum possible sentences under the law. Arbery's sister, Jasmine Arbery, said the men mistakenly deemed Mr. Arbery to be a dangerous criminal because of his dark skin and curly hair. Mr. Arbery was a jogging enthusiast, and his family has said that he had jogged into the neighborhood on the day of his death. Marcus Arbery Sr., his father, told the court, "Not only did they lynch my son in broad daylight, but they killed him whilst he was doing what he loved more than anything else, running." Wanda Cooper Jones, Ahmed Arbery's mother, noted that her son never spoke to his pursuers during the chase. "He never said a word to them. He never threatened them. He just wanted to be left alone," she said. "They were fully committed to their crimes. Let them be fully committed to their consequences." The case is likely to be appealed to the Georgia Supreme Court, but in an interview this week, Ms. Cooper Jones said she was bracing herself for the next trial in federal court, where the three men are charged with hate crimes and attempted kidnapping, and also face potential life sentences. Jury selection in that case is scheduled to begin on 7th of February. "I'll be there every day," she said. "They need to answer to those charges as well." Wanda Cooper Jones said federal prosecutors had contacted her recently and asked if she would be comfortable with a plea deal. She said she told them that she preferred to see the federal case go to trial. Friday's question of parole eligibility resonated differently for the three men. For Travis McMichael, it was about the possibility of being released as early as his mid-60s. But Gregory McMichael, his father, would be in his 90s if he were given the chance to go before a parole board. Likewise, Mr. Bryan would be in his 80s. Robert Rubin, a lawyer for Travis McMichael, argued that his client might have acted recklessly but was trying to look out for his neighbors. Robert Rubin said a maximum sentence for his client would constitute vengeance, and said that a parole board should have a chance to consider freeing Mr. McMichael. Laura Hoag, a lawyer for Gregory McMichael, said he had no criminal record and had carried out thousands of acts of kindness in his lifetime. Kevin Guff, a lawyer for Mr. Bryan, noted that his client had publicly expressed remorse. Mr. Guff made what he admitted was a long-shot argument that the judge should consider a sentence for Mr. Bryan that was effectively more lenient than the mandated minimum. At trial, defense lawyers argued that Travis McMichael had acted in self-defense when he shot Ahmed Arbery. They also argued that the pursuit of Mr. Arbery was legal under a citizen's arrest law that was later significantly dismantled by Georgia lawmakers. Prosecutors had given strong indications before the trial that they would make racism an important component of their case, but in the end, several allegations of racism were not introduced to the nearly all-white jury, either for strategic reasons or because of hurdles presented by the rules of evidence. Instead, the lead prosecutor, Dunikowski, made a plea to jurors' sense of basic fairness and argued that the men had violated rules of common sense when they decided to take the law into their own hands. One of the few hints of racial motive came in her closing argument when Linda Dunikowski said Mr. Arbery had been attacked because he was a black man running down the street. But the accusations of racism that jurors never heard in the state case could potentially be introduced next month in the federal court. They include photographic evidence of Travis McMichael's truck, which was adorned with a vanity plate with the design of the old Georgia state flag, which incorporates the Confederate battle flag. Court records show that prosecutors had considered introducing what they described as other racial evidence, including Facebook posts or text messages from the three men. In a pre-trial hearing, prosecutors read a text message from November of 2019 in which Travis McMichael used a racist slur about black people as he described the idea of shooting a crackhead with gold teeth. In a federal court filing in late December, the lawyer for Mr. Bryan asked the court to exclude evidence that suggested Mr. Bryan had racial animus towards black people, including racially insensitive text messages he made around the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, and witness testimony that would suggest Bryan did not approve of his adopted daughter dating an African-American man. A Georgia state investigator has said that Mr. Bryan told authorities that he heard Travis McMichael use a racist slur shortly after shooting Ahmaud Arbery. Mr. McMichael's lawyer disputed this claim. That allegation may be difficult to bring before a jury if Mr. Bryan declines to take the witness stand, which would deny Travis McMichael his constitutional right to cross-examine a witness against him. According to Justice Department statistics, more than 90% of hate crime defendants adjudicated in U.S. District Court between 2005 and 2019 were convicted. But Paige Pate, a Georgia lawyer and legal analyst, said this trial could prove to be challenging for prosecutors. Racist statements alone, he said, would not be enough to secure a conviction. Proving somebody's a racist doesn't make it a hate crime, he said. You've got to show that the crime was connected to those feelings. In addition to hate crimes, the federal indictment that was issued in April also charges the three men with attempted kidnapping. Both of the McMichaels armed themselves before chasing Ahmaud Arbery, and both are charged with using a firearm during a violent crime.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed
that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. Human rights in general from his perspective. One of the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi had to face was poverty of his time. And obviously, not just his time, but he wanted to pass the message to generations to come until the Day of Judgment. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he looked at the world intently. He looked at every aspect of it, without any exception, of course. He kept the individuals as well as the collective rights of the people in mind and did not ignore anything, which is quite a rigorous task to do, that when you want to solve a problem as big as poverty, you need to look at every possible way to eradicate such a problem, keeping, of course, the rights of individuals and people in mind. A task that many organizations today, with billions of dollars behind their backs and government behind their backs, is trying to eradicate poverty, and they are failing miserably. Why? Because they are looking at things with one eye, from one scope. They're not taking every possible opportunities, and even if they manage to find a way, they will end up stepping on other people's right. So in order for me to, do something for humanity, for example, I'm trying to cure a disease, what these people do, this organization, they go to Africa and they test their vaccines on human beings. They turn them into lab rats, which means they put their lives in danger. Now, this is exactly Amir al-Mu'mineen did not do. He looked at every possible way, keeping in mind that no one should be hurt in the process. He invited the people to look at the beauty of the world and the wonders of creation. At the same time, informed the individuals as well as the society of their rights, so they might acquire the greatest bliss and prosperity. It is always self-reform for Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. He had to begin from within. He explained the rights of the individuals, the rights of society, so that the individuals should help one another by mutual cooperation and endeavor for the prosperity of the society and the benefit for all people if they collectively work together. This is exactly how he tried to achieve poverty, and this is the only way you can achieve it, is when you and I cooperate together to help one another. As long as I'm only thinking of myself, thinking of my wealth, collecting from myself, I'm going to be poor. Now, it says that Elon Musk, 3% of his wealth, will eradicate world hunger. One man only. 3% of his wealth, not all of it, would eradicate hunger itself. Do we see them doing it? Of course not. Let us take a break, and then we come back right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Man himself is composed of three things, obviously a body, a spirit, and sentiments, if we can say the least. Body is a material part of man. It also enjoys right, which must be respected. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, whose efforts were centered on the enforcement of the self and good morals, also endeavored to lay the foundation of society on equity and justice, and to enact justice law for the material and worldly life of man. He tried to create that balance, that yes, we do understand that you have a body, and the body is material in its nature, and it requires material matter. But should we let it loose? Should I let myself indulge in anything I desire? If I desire wealth, should I go and get as greedy as I can, even if it means many people will get, you know, hurt in the process, as we see in Africa, for example, the blood diamond? Or no? Or should I, you know, control myself? If I say, no, I need to control myself, where do I begin? And this is exactly where Amir al-Mu'mineen tapped on. The spiritual aspect of man that needs, if that is cultivated, if that's being taught correctly, it should put a leash on the desire of oneself. So he created this kind of reformation from within. It was also the object of Imam Ali alayhi salam to guide people to the purity of heart and the acquisition of good conduct, and to nurture and train the conscious in such a way that they might shun bad habits of their own accord without being forced, and adorn themselves with good qualities. This was the, you know, as simple as we could make it, was the mission of Amir al-Mu'mineen. To make sure that I get rid of all vices and replace them with virtues. If I have these virtues, then I would learn not to harm another human being. I learn to cooperate with other people. I learn to help other people and feed them and give them from what I have. I share with them. This act itself, it should and it will eradicate poverty if we collectively work towards this aim. If we collectively have this idea, this mentality in our mind, the mentality that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi tried so hard to achieve. However, it is not possible to develop good habits until one has food to eat and dress to wear, and the people cannot acquire means of livelihood until justice is prevailed, which is another issue that we will face in trying to seek virtues. If I'm hungry, good luck to my virtues. Let us continue this topic in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. اللهم صل على محمد وآله 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 صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله
the limelight.
By no means has voting blue meant a change for the better. In fact, the only real difference between Biden and Trump in terms of foreign policy is that instead of mean tweets, more respectful language is used to give the new president the veneer of respectability, says Robert Inlakesh, journalist, in an article titled Biden's Diplomacy is Back, Falls Flat as 2021 West Asia Policy, a Miserable Flop. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Despite President Joe Biden having claimed earlier this year that diplomacy is back and that he would end the war in Yemen, revive the Iran nuclear deal, and settle several other issues, in reality, his West Asia region foreign policy has been just as detrimental to the region as was that of his predecessor. This war has to end. We are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales, Biden said in early February during his first address to the U.S. public on his administration's foreign policy approach. It was a speech that saw him showered with the praise of his supporters, yet we are now in early January 2022, and the war has only intensified, with UN experts estimating that the total death toll by the end of the year will be 377,000. To make things even worse, as Saudi Arabia's bombs target urban centers in Yemen's capital, Sana'a, including the country's primary airport and a maternity hospital, the U.S. just approved another $650 million weapon sales to Riyadh. Instead of withdrawing their support for the Saudis' offensive actions and ending weapon sales, the Biden administration has done the exact opposite and took no action when the war escalated just weeks after the president's statements, igniting an ongoing bloody battle for control of oil-rich Ma'rib province. Yemen is far from an isolated case of the Biden administration saying one thing and doing the opposite, but is perhaps the most urgent of all West Asia region matters to resolve, given the sheer number of civilian casualties that await perpetuation of the status quo. Next on the list of this year's West Asia region catastrophes is Afghanistan, where Biden fulfilled his promise of withdrawal. But with the sudden collapse of the U.S.-backed Afghan government, the country soon fell to the Taliban. In August, infamous scenes of Afghans falling to their deaths after holding on to departing U.S. planes, coupled with a helicopter lift spotted aiding U.S. embassy workers, saw comparisons made with Washington's infamous withdrawal from Saigon in 1975. Violence by American troops was meted out against civilians during the early stages of the Taliban takeover and did not end until every last American troop left. The most notoriously bloody incident was a drone strike that targeted and killed 10 Afghan civilians, 7 of whom were children. Zamari Ahmadi, a 36-year-old who worked for the California-based aid organization Nutrition and Education International, NEI, was killed in that drone strike, along with 6 of his nieces and nephews, symbolizing the lack of protection Afghans got even when working with the United States. So how did the U.S. decide to close the chapter of the failed $2.26 trillion Afghanistan war? Did we punish those responsible for the murder of an aid worker and his family? You guessed it. Not only did the U.S. government defend its actions, it refused to hold anyone to account for one of the last war crimes it committed on Afghan soil in 2021. What then to make of U.S. attempts to righteously blame the Taliban for their acts when Washington itself refuses to hold its own forces to the high standards they expect of others? Washington is also currently freezing approximately $9.5 billion in assets and loans, leaving the newly established government in Kabul unable to feed a starving population suffering under an economic crisis. This does not mean that the Taliban deserve a free pass here for their actions, but neither is this a simple morality play of good and evil, black and white. What the Biden administration's actions attest to is an environment of impunity that shielded coalition forces from accountability, as Washington's withdrawal proved both tactically and strategically disastrous.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the kinds of management in the family. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the kinds of management in the family. When we look at the family and the structure of the family in the Islamic lifestyle, according to the teachings of the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet ﷺ, the management has been divided between the husband and wife. And there are specific things that a husband needs to manage in the family, and there are other specific things which the woman or the wife must take care of. Therefore, we can see in the narrations that even in the narrations it is said that when Imam Ali married Lady Fatima salamu alayha, and after that we can see that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he divided the management of the family between these two personalities, and he said the things that are related to the inside house, these are related to Hazrat Fatima or Lady Fatima, and those things that are related to the outside the house are basically on the shoulders of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And this makes easy for the family members, because Lady Fatima has thanked her father for making such a division, so that now she knows what are her boundaries. And similarly, Imam Ali also thanked him because he knows what to do and what to manage and what to not to be worried about. And this division is very important.